Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy.
Today, we're embarking on a really crucial deep dive. It's titled The Federal News Update for Tuesday, August 12th, 2025.
Yeah, and for this, we've really gone through a pile of sources, you know, articles, research papers, actual government documents. We're trying to pull out the most important nuggets of knowledge, the real insights from what the U.S. federal government is doing over the last 48 hours or so.
Exactly. Our mission here is to give you a definitive intelligence briefing. We want you to understand what happened on August 11th and 12th, 2025, why it happened, right, what legal and political authority was, you know, invoked,
what the immediate reactions were, and critically, what the short-term and long-term implications look like for policy, the economy, American society. Basically, you're going to get a shortcut to being truly well-informed on some really dramatic shifts.
So let's unpack this. These 2 days, August 11th and 12th, 2025, they weren't just, you know, another couple of busy days. They really reveal what looks like a meticulously orchestrated masterclass in using executive power.
Right. We saw this really dramatic assertion of authority. Seems designed to push a sweeping domestic agenda forward.
And critically, this was happening while Congress was, well, out of town, gone for the August recess.
And that's fascinating, isn't it? That backdrop, Congress being away, really amplified the executive branch's power. Mm. It sort of created this political vacuum, limiting any immediate legislative oversight.
Yeah, gave them a clear runway.
Exactly. It allowed for this rapid top-down implementation of a really distinct political, economic, and social vision for the country. Basically letting the executive move chess pieces pretty freely without much immediate pushback.
And we're going to unpack some really big moves today, things that touch multiple facets of American life. We're talking about, first, this unprecedented federal intervention in Washington, D.C.'s governance. That was huge.
Then there's a significant, though maybe temporary, de-escalation in the U.S.-China trade war.
And a trio of executive orders that are fundamentally reshaping things like federal grant making, national health policy, and even how your retirement investments are managed. Lots to cover.
Okay, let's kick things off with August 11th. The executive branch made a move that absolutely captured national attention, asserting federal power directly over Washington, D.C.
Yeah, that really ignited a fierce debate, as you'd expect. But, you know, as we'll see, it wasn't happening in isolation. It was just one part of this broader, pretty aggressive agenda unfolding at the same time.
And it wasn't just something that popped up on the 11th, was it?
No, that's important. Our sources indicate this actually started building over the weekend before. We had over 100 federal agents, FBI, Secret Service, U.S. Marshals already deployed, already patrolling parts of the city.
So that federal presence was already visible, setting the stage.
Right. It definitely set the stage for the more formal declarations that came on Monday morning, the 11th.
Okay, so let's dive deeper into the president's actions on the 11th itself. What exactly happened? Well, on that morning, President Donald J. Trump signed two key documents, a presidential memorandum and an executive order.
And these weren't just symbolic.
Not at all. They were the administration's official designation of a crime emergency in D.C., effectively placing, you know, significant parts of the nation's capital under direct federal control.
And these two documents had different functions, right? A dual approach.
Exactly. They covered both military and civilian aspects. The presidential memorandum titled Restoring Law and Order in the District of Columbia, that was the military piece.
Okay.
In it, the president cited his authority as commander-in-chief of the D.C. National Guard. He directed the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, to mobilize the Guard.
In what numbers?
Well, the memo said, in such numbers as he deems necessary. And, crucially, for an indefinite period until, quote, conditions of law and order have been restored.
Indefinite. Wow. So could they bring in outside troops?
Yes. The memorandum explicitly allowed for activating National Guard units from other states if needed. So it indicated the potential scale could be quite large.
Okay. So that's the military side. What about the civilian side? The police?
Right. Complementing that was the executive order. It declared a crime emergency specifically within the district. And this order brought the city's own police force, the Metropolitan Police Department, the MPD, under direct federal control.
How could they do that?
They invoked a, well, rarely discussed provision of the 1973 D.C. Home Rule Act. It allows for this under certain emergency conditions.
And who was put in charge of the MPD?
Command authority was specifically delegated to the Attorney General, Pam Bondi.
So what was the official reason given for this pretty drastic action?
The stated rationale from the White House was that D.C. was, quote, under siege from out-of-control violent crime, and that the local government had, quote, lost control of public safety.
And they pointed to specific incidents.
They did. They cited several high-profile events to back this up. The murder of two embassy staffers back in May, a congressional intern shooting in June, and, very recently, the assault and attempted carjacking of a Trump administration staffer, Edward Korestein. Those were used as immediate justifications.
And they used statistics, too, I understand, to paint a picture of crisis.
Yes, they did. They framed specific stats to bolster this sense of crisis. They compared D.C.'s 2024 murder rate, which was around 27.5 per 100,000 people, unfavorably, to other international capitals.
Like where?
Like Bogota, which they cited as having a rate closer to 15, Mexico City around 10.6, and even Islamabad, down around 9.2.
So framing it internationally.
Exactly. And the whole intervention was framed not just as a choice, but as a constitutional obligation. They argued it was necessary to protect federal workers, ensure the government could function safely, and allow citizens safe access to federal institutions.
And the president's own words were pretty strong.
Incredibly stark. He called the Capitol a nightmare of murder and crime, a disgrace. He declared it Liberation Day in D.C.
Liberation Day.
Yes. And claimed the city was, quote, overtaken by violent gangs and bloodthirsty criminals, roving mobs of wild youth, drugged-out maniacs, and homeless people. Very, very strong language. Almost apocalyptic, designed to underscore this idea of an emergency.
So this raises the big question. What was the actual legal and constitutional basis for such a sweeping takeover, especially given D.C. has its own elected government?
Right. It's complicated because D.C. is unique. The legal basis for taking over the MPD, the police force, comes from that specific provision in the 1973 D.C. Home Rule Act we mentioned.
The one rarely used.
Exactly. It allows the president to assume control of the city's police for up to 30 days if they declare that special conditions of an emergency nature exist.
And is that considered legally sound?
Well, Professor Steve Lydak from Georgetown Law described it as unsettling and unprecedented in its actual use. But he did confirm it was technically legal.
But only for D.C.
Yes. He emphasized it's a D.C.-specific power. It can't just be replicated in, say, Chicago or New York. And importantly, this was the first time any president had actually invoked this specific power since the act was passed over 50 years ago. That highlights how extraordinary it was.
Okay, so that's the police takeover. What about deploying the National Guard? That's different legally.
It is. The National Guard deployment operates under a different but equally potent legal authority. Unlike state governors, who command their state National Guards unless they're federalized.
Right.
The President of the United States is always the direct commander-in-chief of the D.C. National Guard.
Always.
Always. It's a unique setup. And that allowed the deployment of troops within D.C. for law enforcement support without needing the consent of the local D.C. government. That's a critical distinction from how the Guard is usually deployed in states, which typically requires a governor's request or a federal emergency declaration.
And how many troops were we talking about initially?
The initial announcement mentioned 800 soldiers. But the Pentagon quickly clarified that only about 100 to 200 would actually be on the streets at any given time.
And what was their stated mission?
Limited, according to the Pentagon, to administrative logistics and physical presence in support of law enforcement, not direct policing.
But the president's public statements, they sounded different.
They did. His threats to, quote, bring in the military if it's needed, created a lot of ambiguity and alarm. It kind of blurred those lines between the Guard's supposed support role and active duty military intervention, which involves combat forces not trained for domestic policing. That discrepancy definitely added to the confusion and concern.
Okay, so the administration puts forward this emergency narrative backed by legal justifications. But this is where the story gets really interesting, because that narrative didn't go unchallenged, did it?
Not at all. It was immediately and forcefully challenged by local officials, by civil rights groups. A powerful counter-narrative emerged very quickly.
Based on what? Primarily the crime data.
Yes, primarily. Multiple independent analyses of the D.C. Metropolitan Police's own statistics, cited by sources like PBS NewsHour, AP, the ACLU, directly contradicted the administration's emergency plan.
What did that data show?
It showed that after a spike in 2023, which followed the pandemic disruption, violent crime had actually fallen dramatically. Violent crime hit a 30-year low in 2024, and it dropped another 26% in the first 7 months of 2025.
A 26% drop just this year?
Right. And a Department of Justice report actually corroborated this trend. It found a 35% decrease in violent crime since 2023, with homicides down 32% and armed carjackings, a particularly visible crime, down 53% compared to the previous year.
So the numbers were actually going down significantly.
Consistently downward, which stands in stark contrast to the administration's narrative, which focused on that higher 2024 murder rate while sort of ignoring the clear continued downward trend in 2025.
And how did D.C.'s Mayor Muriel Bowser react?
She publicly rebuked the president's premise. She called the federal action unsettling and unprecedented and wholly unnecessary. Very direct. She stated unequivocally, "We are not experiencing a spike in crime. In fact, we're watching our crime numbers go down." She acknowledged the technical legality under the Home Rule Act, but stressed his declaration of an emergency was a subjective decision, simply not supported by the facts on the ground.
Making it look more political than practical.
That was certainly her implication, that it appeared more politically motivated than a genuine response to a public safety crisis.
And what about civil liberties groups? What was their take?
They responded with intense alarm. They saw this as much bigger than just a D.C. issue. The ACLU of D.C., for example, put out a scathing statement calling the move political theater and a blatantly phony justification for abuse of emergency powers.
Strong words.
Very. And they issued a stark warning. They suggested D.C. was being used as a test case for potentially federalizing police forces in other majority black and brown cities like Chicago or Baltimore. They said the possibility should alarm everyone across the country.
A test case for broader action.
That was the fear. And grassroots organizers, many of whom had apparently been preparing for something like this since the 2020 protests, expressed deep concern about potential civil rights violations, especially for residents of color. Protesters also gathered in the streets almost immediately, showing the public backlash.
But not everyone opposed it. The president had allies supporting this move, right?
Absolutely. It received strong support from his Republican allies in Congress. For instance, Congressman Byron Donalds of Florida put out a statement saying, "Crime is out of control in our nation's capital," and thanked the president for taking action to, quote, "make D.C. safe again."
So, a clear partisan divide.
Very clear. It highlights how different sides can interpret the same situation, or at least the same set of facts, through vastly different political lenses.
Okay, so digging deeper into the implications here. You mentioned this might be more than just about crime statistics. A political masterstroke, you called it.
Well, what's striking is how it was done. It demonstrated power precisely where the federal government had this unique legal leverage over D.C. The fact that the crime emergency justification was, let's say, easily challengeable by publicly available data that strongly suggests the stated reason might not have been the primary driver.
So what else could have been driving it?
What's also fascinating is the language the administration used. It wasn't just about crime. They talked about filth, squalor, homeless people, and this need to renovate D.C., make the capital beautiful.
That sounds like more than just policing.
Exactly. It points towards a much broader project. Maybe some kind of social reengineering, a top-down reshaping of the city itself, going far beyond just traditional law enforcement.
That's a powerful assessment. It sounds like this action effectively established a new playbook.
It seems that way. Leverage D.C.'s unique legal status, create this powerful, restoring order narrative for a national audience, and simultaneously override the city's own democratic will and its elected government.
So the crime emergency becomes a convenient pretext.
A pretext, perhaps, for a broader ideological project, and potentially a model that could be deployed against other politically opposed urban centers, making D.C. a sort of chilling test case.
And the precedent that sets?
It's concerning for many, using federal law enforcement, even military assets, for domestic political goals, especially when contradicted by the facts, that risks eroding the foundation of evidence-based governance, where policy is ideally guided by data, not just narrative.
And using that dormant Home Rule Act power for the first time.
That in itself is a radical step. And when you place it in context, following similar, though maybe less sweeping, federal deployments in 2020 and more recently in Los Angeles, it starts to normalize federal intervention in local affairs.
Mm.
It shifts it from being an extraordinary measure for truly undeniable emergencies to potentially becoming a recurring tool of the executive branch.
Okay, that D.C. takeover definitely dominated the headlines on the 11th. But while all eyes were on federal agents in the Capitol, you're saying the executive branch was also busy elsewhere, quietly advancing other big agenda items.
Absolutely. And this is crucial to understanding the overall strategy. While the D.C. drama played out publicly, the administration was strategically using the quieter machinery of the administrative state to push forward a broad and transformative policy agenda.
A kind of shock and awe governance, you called it earlier.
Exactly. It's vital to see these actions not in isolation, but as synchronized parts of a larger coordinated effort.
So what was happening on the administrative front?
One really significant piece was Executive Order 14332. Its title was Improving Oversight of Federal Grant Making.
Okay, grants. That affects a lot of organizations.
Billions of dollars. This order was made public for inspection on August 11th, officially published on the 12th. And legal experts from big firms like Holland & Knight and advocacy groups like the National Council of Nonprofits, they see this as a fundamental overhaul designed to centralize political control over federal funding.
Centralize political control. What does that mean in practice for, say, a nonprofit or a university trying to get a federal grant? Is it harder now?
It introduces several key changes that are causing quite a stir. First, it mandates that senior political appointees must now review and approve all new funding opportunity announcements and all discretionary grant awards.
Political appointees, not career staff.
Right. It effectively shifts the final say-so from career program staff and peer reviewers, who are usually the subject matter experts evaluating the proposals, to the political leadership. That adds a whole new layer of scrutiny, potential delay, and, well, political consideration.
And I heard there were ideological strings attached too.
Yes, that's a profound change. The order explicitly prohibits grant funds from being used for certain activities.
Such as?
Activities related to racial preferences, anything denying a sex binary or asserting sex is mutable, any support for undocumented immigrants, or initiatives that are deemed to promote anti-American values.
Wow. So federal money gets actively steered away from programs that don't align with the administration's specific ideology.
Regardless of their past effectiveness or scientific merit. Yes. It injects ideology directly into the funding criteria.
And there was something else. A termination clause. That sounds ominous.
It is unsettling for grantees. The order requires all future grant agreements to include a termination for a convenience clause.
Meaning?
Meaning, a federal agency can end a grant at any time if it's decided the grant no longer advances current administration priorities. And this is regardless of the grantee's performance or whether they followed all the rules of the original agreement.
So you could have your funding pulled mid-project just because priorities shifted in Washington.
That's the implication. Imagine planning long-term based on a grant and then having it yanked because of shifting political winds. Plus, it directs the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, to limit how much grant money can be used for indirect costs, things like overhead.
How does that play out?
Well, it effectively favors institutions with lower overhead rates and competitive grants that could potentially disadvantage larger universities or research institutions that naturally have higher indirect cost rates due to their infrastructure.
So the immediate impact seems pretty clear. A significant slowdown in grant processing, and just a huge cloud of political and ideological uncertainty hanging over anyone seeking or relying on federal funds.
Precisely. Funding could be denied, delayed, or even revoked based on shifting political alignments rather than just the quality of the work or the need it addresses. It fundamentally changes the dynamic.
Okay, let's shift gears from domestic grants to international trade. Also on the 11th, the White House released a statement about U.S.-China trade talks.
Yes, a joint statement on U.S.-China economic and trade meeting in Stockholm. This came after some critical meetings between top officials.
Who is involved?
On the U.S. side, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent and U.S. Trade Representative Jameson Greer. They met with Chinese Vice Premier He Lifeng.
And the big news was?
They announced the 90-day extension of the tariff truce that was first put in place back in May 2025. This was really crucial news, especially for businesses caught in the crossfire.
So what does this truce actually mean? Are the tariffs gone?
No, not gone. It's definitely more of a pause than a full resolution. Both the U.S. and China agreed to continue suspending 24 percentage points of their respective retaliatory tariffs.
Okay, so what does that leave?
It keeps the additional tariff rate at 10%, which is still significant, but it averted what would have been an immediate and severe escalation. Without the extension, tariffs would have, quote, skyrocketed back to those really prohibitive, almost triple-digit levels we saw earlier in the year.
So it provides some short-term stability.
Crucial short-term stability for businesses in global markets, yes. But it's vital to remember this isn't an end to the fundamental trade conflict. Substantial underlying tariffs are still in place. It just signals a temporary de-escalation, some breathing room.
Okay, so we have the D.C. takeover, the grant overhaul, the China trade truce extension. Were there other executive actions brewing on the 11th as well?
Yes. The Federal Register's public inspection list for that day showed a whole flurry of other executive actions already lined up, almost like they were timed to drop together.
Under that special filing category.
Exactly, which usually indicates priority. The executive office of the president filed 5 presidential documents under that category.
What were they?
They included Executive Order 14330, which deals with extending 401k investment options. We'll definitely dig into that one more when we get to 12.
Mm.
There was also Executive Order 14331 on fair banking.
Fair banking? What's that about?
Well, it flew a bit under the radar compared to D.C., but it's expected to direct federal lending practices, potentially steering capital towards specific industries or communities based on, you know, national economic priorities.
Right.
Using federal influence to shape lending.
Interesting. What else?
We also saw a proclamation for National Purple Heart Day, symbolic but important recognition for wounded service members.
Mm.
And significantly, a memorandum revising U.S. policy toward Cuba.
A shift on Cuba.
Potentially. It could impact trade, travel, engagement, signaling a departure from previous approaches. And in the national security realm, the State Department filed notices to formally amend the designation of the Balochistan Liberation Army as a specially designated global terrorist. That carries real diplomatic and financial weight.
So a lot of high-level action, but the everyday business of government kept going too.
Oh, absolutely. The Federal Register published 80 documents from 38 different agencies just on the 11th. That includes all the routine but essential stuff.
Like what?
Information collection proposals from the CDC and the FAA, notices about public meetings for the Civil Rights Commission, updates to systems of records in the Department of Defense. It's a reminder that even when big dramatic shifts are happening, the vast machinery of day-to-day government keeps grinding away.
So looking at August 11th as a whole, the sheer volume and significance of these executive actions happening almost all at once, it really points to a deliberate strategy, doesn't it?
It really does seem like a sophisticated governance strategy. You have the dramatic DC takeover consuming the media spotlight, acting almost like a national distraction.
While behind the scenes.
Fundamental policy shifts are being executed on multiple, seemingly unrelated fronts. Federal grants, trade with China, preparing to reshape retirement savings and banking, signaling foreign policy shifts.
And the timing. With Congress out of session.
That's crucial. It minimized any chance for immediate institutional pushback. No public hearings, no quick legislative countermeasures. It allowed these actions to proceed with much less immediate scrutiny.
This shock and awe governance approach, it seems designed to overwhelm potential opposition.
That appears to be the effect, if not the explicit intent. By initiating major disruptive changes across so many different areas at once, it makes it incredibly difficult for opposition groups, the media, even the public, to mount a focused, coordinated response to any single issue.
Creates a sense of constant flux.
Exactly. An environment where transformative changes can be pushed through the administrative state at high velocity, often before real resistance can organize, or before detailed critiques can even be widely understood. It leverages the government's own machinery to enact a rapid, top-down policy revolution.
That's a powerful and maybe a bit unsettling picture of how executive power can operate. Does this shock and awe mean the other branches, Congress and the courts, were just sidelined during this? What was Congress doing on the 11th?
Well, as we noted, they were essentially absent from the immediate action. On August 11th, Congress was completely out of session. Both the House and the Senate were deep into their scheduled August recess, sometimes called a state work period. They weren't due back until early September.
So no meetings, no hearings, no votes.
None at all scheduled for that day,
yeah.
Which meant there was simply no institutional mechanism available for an immediate legislative response to what the executive branch was
doing.
Right,
creating a vacuum.
A significant political vacuum. It effectively ceded the entire stage to the president. Individual members could, and some did, issue statements from their districts, but there was no collective forum for debate, no way to question officials like the Attorney General or the Secretary of Defense immediately, no process to start drafting legislative countermeasures. It really amplified the executive's power and allowed its narrative to dominate without a formal unified challenge from Congress.
And what about the courts? Was the judicial branch involved at all on the 11th?
The U.S. Supreme Court itself released no decisions on August 11th. They were also in their summer recess, effectively. But legal commentary published that day really highlighted the growing importance and controversy surrounding the court's emergency docket, often called the shadow docket.
The shadow docket, that's for urgent requests, right?
Exactly. Think of it as the Supreme Court's ER. It handles urgent requests for things like stays and injunctions, often without the full briefing or oral arguments you see in regular cases. But it's increasingly being used for major national policy issues.
And why is that relevant here?
Because any legal challenges to the DC takeover or that grant-making executive order would almost certainly land first on this emergency docket. They demand a very rapid judicial response from the justices, potentially setting major precedents very quickly with less public scrutiny.
So the courts could become a battleground very soon.
Almost inevitably. Also on the 11th, a formal petition was filed with the Supreme Court, specifically asking it to overturn the landmark 2015 same-sex marriage ruling, Obergefell v. Hodges.
Wow, seeking to overturn Obergefell.
Yes. It's a clear signal that these deeply contentious social issues remain very active in the judicial pipeline and could resurface at the highest court.
Any notable action in the lower courts?
The California Supreme Court issued a significant ruling in a case called Hohenschildt v. Superior Court. They narrowly interpreted a state law about arbitration fees, apparently crafting the ruling specifically to avoid having the state law invalidated by the Federal Arbitration Act.
So state courts navigating federal law.
Exactly. It exemplifies that ongoing legal friction between federal and state authority, a tension that's really at the heart of many of these administration policies. It shows how state courts try to maintain their own sphere within the federal system. And, more routinely, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit announced some standard amendments to its local procedural rules.
Okay, so summing up August 11th, it was really defined by this powerful, multi-pronged assertion of executive authority.
Absolutely. The dramatic D.C. intervention was the very public face, dominating the news, setting a stark tone.
Yeah.
But it was accompanied by this broader administrative push, reshaping federal grants, managing the China trade relationship. It demonstrates a really sophisticated approach to using presidential power.
And the backdrop of Congress being in recess was critical. It created the perfect environment for unilateral action, amplifying the executive's power.
Right. It left dissent mainly to local officials like Mayor Bowser, civil rights groups, and looking forward, the potential for intervention by the courts.
So the day really established a clear pattern. Using the full and sometimes novel extent of presidential power to drive a specific ideological agenda, often directly defying local authorities, established norms, maybe even verifiable facts, all while controlling the public narrative. Okay, let's move into the next day, August 12th. It seems the focus of federal activity pivoted a bit, didn't it? Maybe less direct law enforcement, more towards economic, health, financial policy?
That's right. The momentum continued, but the emphasis shifted. Again, it was the executive branch driving the agenda, really leveraging its regulatory and administrative powers, and Congress, of course, remained in recess.
So let's unpack what happened on the 12th, because these policies have some really direct impacts on people's lives, health, money.
Absolutely. First, that 90-day extension of the tariff truce with China, the one announced the day before, it officially took effect on August 12th.
Formalized how?
It was formalized by the president's executive order being published in the Federal Register that morning. This was the action that formally averted that immediate severe escalation in the trade war. If that hadn't happened, tariffs would have, as reports said, skyrocketed back to those really damaging levels we saw in the spring.
So it kept the status quo in place, basically.
Essentially, yes. It maintained the status quo that it had been established back in May. That meant keeping the additional U.S. tariff rate on a huge range of Chinese goods at 30%, and the corresponding Chinese retaliatory tariff rate on U.S. goods at 10%.
Which provided that temporary relief.
A welcome, though temporary, reprieve for businesses and financial markets. It offered that critical moment of stability.
How did businesses react?
Industry groups, like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the U.S. China Business Council, expressed considerable relief. They called the extension critical for short-term certainty and for buying time for potentially more comprehensive negotiations.
But still concerned long-term.
Definitely. They remained worried about the high baseline tariffs that were still in place and about the persistent long-term uncertainty that makes business planning and investment really difficult.
And what was the broader read on this move? Pragmatic.
Analysts generally saw it as a pragmatic move for both sides. For the U.S., it helped relieve some inflationary pressure domestically. For China, dealing with a slowing economy, it offered a more predictable trade environment, at least for a few months.
And politically?
Politically, the extension was widely seen as a necessary step to maybe lay the groundwork for a potential high-stakes summit between President Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping later in the fall.
And all this was happening against a backdrop of trade actually falling between the two countries.
Yes, demonstrably falling since the beginning of the year. A direct result of that earlier escalating tariff war, where rates had peaked at truly unsustainable levels like 145% for the U.S. and 125% for China back in April. So the truce stopped things from getting even worse.
Okay, let's turn to health policy now. Also on the 12th, something called the President's Commission to Make America Healthy. Again, MAHA submitted a report.
That's right. The commission, which is chaired by the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., formally submitted its Make Our Children Healthy Again strategy to the president.
Sounds ambitious. What's the core idea?
It is ambitious. The full text wasn't released publicly on the 12th, but based on our sources, its core ideas are rooted in a very specific and frankly quite controversial framework for why childhood chronic diseases are rising.
What causes do they identify?
The commission pointed to four main drivers. First, poor diet, specifically blaming ultra-processed foods, sugars, and chemical additives. Second, environmental toxins, things like pesticides, PFAS chemicals, even fluoride in drinking water, which they argue are widespread and underregulated.
Okay, diet and toxins. What else?
Third, a combination of insufficient physical activity and chronic stress, which they link partly to technology use. And fourth, and this is where it gets particularly contentious, what they call the over-medicalization of children.
Over-medicalization. What does that mean in this context?
It means questioning the currently recommended childhood vaccine schedule and also criticizing established medical bodies like the American Medical Association for, in the commission's view, disciplining doctors who spread what it considers health disinformation.
So it's challenging mainstream medical advice.
Like directly, yeah.
And the overall goal is?
The stated goal is a coordinated transformation of our food, health, and scientific systems to prioritize prevention and overall well-being, moving away from just treating disease after it happens.
Does the strategy propose concrete actions?
It does. Some pretty dramatic ones. It outlines a national timeline to phase out petroleum-based food dyes, like FD&C Red Number 40 that's common in candies, drink. It also calls for overhauling the FDA's generally recognized as safe, or GRAS designation for food ingredients. That's the system many additives use to get onto the market without extensive testing.
So tightening up food additive rules.
That's the idea. Additionally, it proposes launching something called Operation Stork Speed to investigate and improve infant formula nutrition, and promoting a significant move away from animal testing and drug development and research, pushing for alternative methods.
So these aren't minor tweaks.
Not at all. They represent a fundamental reevaluation of public health priorities, or at least the priorities as seen by this commission.
How has this MAHA initiative been received by the broader public health community?
Very mixed and often quite critical. While many experts agree that addressing issues like poor diet and environmental exposures is important,
sure,
serious alarms have been raised about the initiative's scientific foundation and its potential consequences.
What are the main concerns?
Well, critics argue it's a dangerous oversimplification of chronic disease. From a scientific standpoint, these conditions usually arise from complex interactions, genetics, lifestyle, socioeconomic factors, not just, you know, specific toxins named by the commission.
And the politics of it.
There are deep concerns that the initiative politicizes science, that it elevates what critics call pet peeves, like fluoride, questioning its safety in drinking water, despite decades of scientific consensus on its benefits for dental health.
And the vaccine issue is obviously a big one.
Hugely significant. Critics are extremely worried about casting doubt on the safety and efficacy of vaccines. They warn this risks eroding public trust in essential health institutions, potentially undermining decades of progress in public health by discouraging life-saving immunizations. That could lead to outbreaks of preventable diseases. This politicization of health science is deeply concerning for many in the medical world.
Okay, now for something that hits close to home for many people's finances. Also, on August 12th, Executive Order 40330 was officially published. The title was Democratizing Access to Alternative Assets for 401k Investors. This sounds like a major shift for retirement savings.
It's potentially transformative, yes. This order directs the Department of Labor, DOL, and the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, to re-examine the rules and issue new guidance. The goal: to make it easier to include alternative assets in 401k and other similar retirement plans, known as defined contribution or DC plans.
Alternative assets, what exactly falls under that umbrella?
It's defined quite broadly. It includes things like private equity, private credit, real estate, commodities, infrastructure projects, and significantly actively managed investment vehicles that invest in digital assets like cryptocurrencies.
Cryptocurrencies and 401ks, that's new.
Traditionally, yes. These kinds of assets have largely been off-limits for individual 401k savers, mainly because of their complexity and perceived risk.
So what's the administration's stated reason for pushing this change?
The stated goal is to democratize investing. The idea is to give the more than 90 million Americans who have these DC plans access to the same potential for higher returns and better portfolio diversification that are currently enjoyed mostly by wealthy individuals and large institutional funds, like big pension plans.
Leveling the playing field is the argument.
That's the narrative. A White House research paper released alongside the order even estimated that expanding access just to private equity could generate a GDP benefit of up to $35 billion.
But there's another angle here too, isn't there? Something about reducing risk for the plan managers.
Yes, that's a central aim of the order. It explicitly seeks to relieve the regulatory burdens and litigation risk that have historically made plan fiduciaries hesitant to offer these complex, often riskier assets.
Fiduciaries, those are the people legally required to act in the saver's best interest, right? Under ERISA.
Yeah.
Exactly. ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, is the bedrock law protecting retirement savers. It puts a legal duty on fiduciaries to act prudently. So, easing their litigation risk, well, that raises a big question.
Yeah.
What does this mean for the safety of your retirement funds?
How have people reacted to this? Is it seen as a good thing?
Reactions are sharply divided. It's created a real tug of war. On one side, the financial industry, big trade groups like the Investment Company Institute, ICI representing mutual funds, SIFMO representing brokers, they lauded the move.
Why?
They argue long-term savers will benefit from diversification. It expands choices appropriately. And of course, the alternative asset managers themselves who manage things like private equity and hedge funds. They've long coveted access to the trillions, over $12 trillion held in these DC retirement accounts. For them, this order is a landmark opportunity, potentially opening up huge new revenue streams from management fees.
Okay, so the industry likes it. What about consumer advocates? They raise significant red flags, big ones. They warn this policy exposes average, often financially unsophisticated, retirement savers to assets known for higher fees, a real lack of transparency, poor liquidity, meaning they're hard to sell quickly if you need the money, without taking a big loss and extreme volatility, especially things like crypto.
Groups like AARP.
Yes. Organizations like AARP specifically highlighted the speculative nature of crypto and warned about the profound risks, especially for older workers nearing retirement. For them, a major downturn in these kinds of assets could be absolutely catastrophic with little time to recover.
And the concern about weakening protections for savers.
That's key. The worry is that the order's directive to curb litigation risk for fiduciaries could significantly weaken those essential protections under ERISA. ERISA is the primary legal tool savers have if they believe their plan was managed imprudently. Weakening that recourse shifts more risk onto the individual saver.
So looking at these actions on the 12th, the China truce, the MAHA health strategy, the 401k order taken together, they paint a picture of a really ambitious agenda, right? Using federal power to reshape big chunks of the economy.
Absolutely. It reveals a coherent strategy. The China tariff truce, while a de-escalation, fits into a broader strategic use of tariffs as a tool to influence global trade and maybe incentivize domestic production. The MAHA initiative aims to transform huge industries, food, pharmaceuticals through new regulations like banning food dyes and potentially redirecting spending through reforms to programs like SNAP food assistance.
And the 401k order.
That's a classic deregulatory move. It's designed to remove legal and regulatory hurdles with the goal of funneling trillions in private retirement savings into new, higher risk, and not incidentally, higher fee asset classes.
What's the common thread here?
The common thread seems to be a vision of an activist executive branch, one that actively manages the economy to achieve specific nationalistic and ideological goals, acting as a market shaper internationally with trade, domestically with consumer health, and in private investment markets. It's a very proactive, top-down approach to economic policy.
And that democratization narrative used for the 401k policy, you mentioned it's a powerful framing.
It is. It's presented as this populist victory, empowering the common investor with the tools of the wealthy, giving you the same opportunities.
But you're saying there's a catch.
On the surface, it sounds great, but it cleverly obscures a fundamental imbalance, critics argue. The most certain guaranteed beneficiaries are the alternative asset management firms. They stand to gain enormous sums in management fees from this vast new pool of retirement money.
All the risks.
The immense risks, the volatility, the illiquidity, the lack of transparency, those get shifted primarily onto the individual savers who may not fully understand these complex products or the risks involved.
And making it harder to sue if things go wrong.
Exactly. The simultaneous move to potentially weaken fiduciary litigation risk under ERISA further tilts the scales away from protecting the saver. So it's a strategy that reframes a high-risk, arguably pro-industry deregulatory initiative as a measure of fairness and empowerment, effectively masking the potential costs for millions of American retirement accounts.
So amidst all these major transformative announcements on the 12th, the regular gears of government kept turning.
Oh, yes. Largely out of the spotlight, the routine business continued. The Federal Register that day contained 85 documents from 29 different agencies. It just reflects the vast scope of ongoing administrative work that keeps the government functioning day to day.
Can you give an example?
Sure. The Department of Commerce's International Trade Administration issued final anti-dumping and countervailing duty orders on certain brake drums imported from China and Turkey.
Meaning
they finalized penalties on those imports after a lengthy investigation determined they were being sold unfairly cheap or subsidized, harming U.S. manufacturers. That's a concrete enforcement outcome of trade policy, a real-world impact.
Any other examples of routine work?
Yeah, there was administrative housekeeping, like the Department of the Interior's Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, BOAM, publishing a final rule to get rid of an old, expired regulation about geophysical data extensions that wasn't relevant anymore, just cleaning up the rule book.
Okay.
Similarly, the Department of Labor's Employee Benefits Security Administration, EBSA, published a notice withdrawing an earlier notice about discontinuing some data collection, just routine procedural stuff that streamlines bureaucracy.
But you mentioned earlier a sort of ironic update from OPM.
Right. In a moment of almost sheer bureaucratic contrast to the high drama, the Office of Personnel Management, OPM, which manages the federal workforce, posted an update on its operational status page for federal agencies in D.C.
And what did it say, given the crime emergency?
It read, open. Employees are expected to begin the workday on time. Normal operating procedures are in effect.
So while the White House is declaring a crime emergency with violent gangs, OPM is basically saying, business as usual, folks. Get to work on time.
Exactly. It starkly highlighted the disconnect between the administration's crisis rhetoric just 24 hours earlier and the actual day-to-day operational reality for the federal government and the Capitol. Really puts the emergency framing into perspective.
A telling detail. Now, just to check back on the other branches, on August 12th, Congress still out.
Still out. Both the House and Senate remained in their August recess. The official calendar showed no scheduled floor activity, no committee work. The Senate did convene, but only for one of those brief pro forma sessions.
Which are just formalities.
Right. They last only minutes. No legislative business happens. They're typically just to meet constitutional requirements about adjournment. So effectively, Congress was still dormant.
Meaning the executive branch continued to have the policy stage entirely to itself.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
This continued legislative absence allowed those major initiatives on health and finance to be announced and advanced without any immediate institutional challenge or oversight from Congress.
Yeah.
That key check on executive power was still effectively offline.
And the Supreme Court? Any action there on the 12th?
No public actions from SCOTUS on that day either, reinforcing the general quietness from the judicial branch during this specific period.
So where did the main judicial news come from?
The most notable item came from the U.S. Sentencing Commission. This is an independent agency within the judicial branch that sets the guidelines for federal criminal sentencing.
What did they announce?
They announced their policy priorities for the upcoming 2025-2026 amendment cycle. Their focus areas included further examination of sentencing guidelines for offenses involving fentanyl and methamphetamine, reflecting the ongoing drug crisis, as well as fraud and human smuggling. It shows their effort to keep federal sentencing aligned with current crime trends.
And state courts kept working.
Yes. State Supreme Courts in Georgia and Tennessee and various federal appellate courts continued their regular work of hearing cases and releasing opinions. The wheels of justice kept turning at those levels.
Okay, so let's synthesize August 12th. It really showcased the administration's ability to push its agenda hard on multiple high-impact fronts all at the same time.
Definitely. While the China tariff truce offered a moment of de-escalation internationally, It was quickly overshadowed domestically by these executive actions set to cause significant disruption and debate in American health and financial sectors. It signaled clear, decisive shifts in policy direction.
And the formal submission of the MAHA strategy, the official publication of that 401k executive order, these really solidified the administration's commitment to a transformative and, let's face it, highly contentious vision for federal regulation.
Absolutely. And the fact that these far-reaching policies were all advanced through executive fiat, essentially by decree, while Congress was quiet, it underscores that deliberate governance strategy we talked about, centered squarely on the power of the presidency. It allowed for rapid, sweeping changes without immediate legislative debate or pushback.
Mm.
So looking back at that 48-hour period, August 11th and 12th, 2025, the Trump administration executed this series of really decisive, high-impact actions. And it's clear these weren't just isolated incidents. They look like interconnected pieces of a coherent, rapidly implemented agenda, a clear pattern of strategic governance.
Right. In just 2 days, it asserted unprecedented federal control over D.C.'s law enforcement and governance, pushed a broad deregulatory agenda in finance with that 401k order, laid out a radical new direction for national health policy via the MAHA Commission, all while managing this fragile but critical truce in the U.S.-China trade war. It truly was a whirlwind of executive action.
And from these 2 days, you can really see three dominant trends emerging. These offer crucial insights, I think, into the current landscape of federal power. First, what we might call governance by presidential decree, or executive fiat, as some legal scholars term it.
Meaning relying heavily on executive orders, memos.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Relying on executive orders, presidential memoranda, and the administrative rulemaking process to enact these sweeping policy changes. Changes that, in another time, might have faced months or years of intense legislative debate and negotiation in Congress.
The upside is speed.
It allows for incredible speed and decisiveness, yes. But it also raises profound questions, questions about democratic legitimacy, about institutional checks and balances, and critically for you, the listener, questions about the long-term durability of policies that can potentially be undone by the next administration with just another stroke of a pen. It means policies can shift very rapidly.
Okay, trend one, governance by decree. What's the second?
Second, what looks like the politicization of the administrative state.
Awesome.
Well, that federal grant-making executive order, with its ideological criteria, and the MAHA health initiative, with its questioning of established science, they clearly demonstrate an intent to infuse traditionally nonpartisan functions of government administrative, regulatory, scientific functions with explicit political and ideological priorities.
So shaping everything from who gets funding to public health advice based on a specific worldview?
It seems that way. It seeks to align the vast machinery of government, the bureaucracy, with the administration's specific political agenda. And that challenges the longstanding norm, or at least the ideal, of an independent civil service and expert-led agencies making decisions based primarily on evidence or established procedure.
Okay, politicization. And the third trend.
Third, the power of narrative-driven policy.
Explain that.
Look at the D.C. takeover, the crime emergency narrative, or the democratization narrative for the 401k changes. These highlight a really sophisticated strategy of crafting powerful political stories, powerful narratives to drive policy forward.
And these narratives work, even if the facts are debatable.
They can be highly effective in mobilizing a political base, in framing the public debate in a certain way. Even when, as we saw with D.C., they might be directly contradicted by verifiable data, or when, as with the 401ks, they obscure the true balance of risk and reward for the public.
So the story becomes more powerful than the facts.
This trend suggests a potential move away from purely evidence-based policymaking towards a model where the power of the story, the emotional appeal of the narrative, can sometimes supersede the power of the facts, which makes it absolutely essential for you, the listener, to critically examine the stated reasons behind policies and look for the underlying data and implications.
Okay, those are three significant trends. So looking forward, what does this all mean for you? What should people be watching closely in the coming weeks and months?
Well, these developments create several critical areas that really warrant close monitoring. Think of it as a roadmap for understanding what comes next. First, obviously, legal and constitutional challenges.
To the DC takeover and the grant order.
Exactly. The D.C. takeover, with its unprecedented use of the Home Rule Act, and that federal grant-making executive order, with its new ideological rules, they're almost certain to face immediate aggressive legal challenges.
Where will those play out?
Watch these cases closely. they'll likely move very quickly, probably straight to the Supreme Court's emergency docket. And they could result in landmark rulings on the separation of powers, the limits of executive authority, the balance between federal and local control. The outcomes will set precedents for years.
Okay, legal challenges. What's second?
Second, keep a close eye on U.S.-China negotiations. That 90-day tariff truce is just a temporary pause, remember. It doesn't resolve the underlying tensions.
So what's the key indicator?
The key thing to watch will be the substance, and maybe just as importantly, the tone, of the negotiations between U.S. and Chinese officials leading up to that November 10th deadline.
What would signal a breakthrough or a breakdown?
Well, if we see signs of a more permanent grand bargain emerging, or maybe the announcement of a leader summit between Trump and Xi, that would signal a significant breakthrough, a more stable economic outlook. Conversely, if the rhetoric turns hostile again, or if there's just no progress, that could suggest a re-escalation of the trade war. And that would have global economic repercussions impacting supply chains, consumer prices, everything.
Got it. Third area to watch.
Third, regulatory implementation and industry impact. These executives' orders, their directives, now they have to be translated into actual formal regulations by the federal agency.
Like the 401k.
Precisely. How the Department of Labor and the SEC actually implement that 401k order, especially if they create any safe harbors that might protect fiduciaries from lawsuits that will critically determine the real-world impact. On the retirement industry, yes, but crucially, on individual savers. It will clarify just how much risk is really being shifted onto individual accounts.
And the MAHA health strategy.
Similarly, the specific actions the FDA and HHS take to implement the more controversial parts of the MAHA strategy, like phasing out food dyes or issuing guidance that questions vaccine schedules, those will provoke strong reactions from the food industry, the pharmaceutical industry, the public health community.
Mm-hmm.
We need to track those specific actions for their practical impact on American health and consumer choice.
Okay. And the final area to monitor.
Finally, watch for the playbook in other cities.
Mm.
Remember the warning from civil liberties groups about DC being a test case.
Right.
The tactics and the rhetoric used in that federal intervention in Washington might very well serve as a model for future actions. So it's crucial to monitor whether the administration threatens or actually attempts to replicate this playbook, declaring emergencies, asserting federal authority in other U.S. cities.
Yeah.
Particularly, perhaps, cities with political leadership that opposes the White House.
That could signal a broader strategy.
It could signal a broader strategy of federal intervention in local governance.
Yeah.
Really testing the limits of federalism in new and potentially disruptive ways.
So reflecting on this deep dive into just 48 hours of federal action, August 11th and 12th, what really stands out to you? For me, it's just the sheer breadth, the speed, the decisiveness of the executive action, a real demonstration of top-down power.
Indeed. It's undeniable. And this period really throws those power dynamics into sharp relief, doesn't it? Especially when one branch acts so decisively while another branch, Congress, is effectively out of session.
It does, which leads to maybe the big question for you, our listeners, to think about.
Yeah, it raises this fundamental question. In an era where we see these rapid top-down policy shifts being enacted by the executive branch, sometimes bypassing traditional debate, how do we, as citizens, ensure accountability? How do we maintain that crucial balance between allowing for decisive action when needed and preserving democratic oversight and deliberation? It's a tough question for all of us.
It really is. A crucial thought to chew on. We hope this deep dive has given you a clearer, more granular picture of the intricate workings of the U.S. federal government during those 2 days, and importantly, its far-reaching impacts on policy, the economy, and American society. We'll be here to unpack more for you next time on the Deep Dive.